This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
How are you feeling then? The countdown is on to the first ever Manchester Derby FA Cup final, and after a couple of weeks of matches not really mattering anymore, the pressure is back on. It's almost 12 years since City have faced United at Wembley, and this will be only the third time it's ever happened, so how are the nerves holding up? Welcome to this week's Blue Moon podcast, where we're either going to be ramping up the hype ahead of the first huge final of the season, or we're going to be trying to calm you down and take your mind off it. We'll let you decide which one of those you'd like it to be. Also on today's show, with the Premier League season now over and City confirmed as champions for the third time in succession, it's time to open the bad take amnesty. All of our daft things that we've thought throughout the season go on display, and we can promise absolutely no judgment whatsoever. We're all friends here. Speaking of which, I'm David Mooney, and joining me for this week's show are two City fans, Joe Butterfield.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad, thanks, Joe. And John Nelgott.
Hello, mate. Thanks for having me.
No problem at all. Welcome to the show. So, it's the Manchester Derby at Wembley to come off the back of a week that, well, off the back of a few weeks that hasn't really mattered. Jordan, what's it like to have games that mean something again?
Yeah, it was a bit of a strange week, really, wasn't it, with the Brighton and Brentford games not meaning anything, and also the Chelsea one as well. I do find myself in a bit of a weird situation when those games happen, though, although they don't happen too frequently, because even though the most important thing for us over the last week has been getting through without any major injuries, I still got this desire like we need to win.
Got to win.
I'm never happy with... And that's what we used to as well. So it all of a sudden feels very strange to have these games, which have effectively been like a pre-season to the start of the season, where we're going to have two absolutely huge games. It's been a welcome break because I did have a bit of football fatigue, but hopefully now we're in the best possible position because of the three games that didn't mean anything to go and win the treble.
Yeah, Joe, it kind of reminds you, doesn't it, what we're in this for? Because as much as, yeah, it was great celebrating the title win against Chelsea and then the Brighton game, we went into it with a fairly strong team, so we're going into it thinking, well, this might be a good game. And then on the last day of the season, I just, like, with the greatest will in the world, I just didn't really care. I couldn't get myself up for it. And then all of a sudden you're thinking, well, okay, now we've got two finals to play for. This is what we want to feel out of football, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when the when the actual game came around, when the Chelsea game came around, it was like, well, this game kind of, I could feel like that meant something, because it was the game where we were lifting the trophy, and you kind of want to, like Jordan says, you want to win that. Like, that's something that you just want to inherently win. But Brighton, I was away with work and wasn't really too bothered about trying to find somewhere to watch it, so I didn't, and just kind of wasn't fussed. Brentford, it wasn't on Sky, and I wasn't really bothered enough to sort of find a stream for it. I've kind of used these two games as a bit of time to just sort of, like you say, the football fatigue was very real during that time. And having games that don't really mean anything at the end of a season like this are kind of a bit of... They can be a bit like, well, what's the point? Like, obviously, I still caught up the highlights. I still kept up with, people watching it and things like that. But like you say, the games that are coming, like these next two games, like, they're just like, yeah, it's the level of game that everybody dreams of, these two games, like having a treble on the line with an FA Cup and a Champions League final. It's like, it's above anything that we've really experienced. Yeah. Up to this point, even with how mad things have been in the last sort of 10-12 years, this is still somehow like another level, another notch above that.
Yeah, and I mean, even with the last couple of games, so even the Brentford game, for instance, Guardiola had issues with that, didn't he, Jordan? He couldn't win. Well, if he went strong, then we'd all be going, oh, the players will get tired and injured. They won't be ready for the finals. And then if he made changes, and we're now sitting here going, well, they're all going to be out of rhythm and they're not going to have the right pace for the game. So, I mean, ultimately, just doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, I think he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't with the three games as well. We've not been aided by the fact that, contrary to popular belief, we don't have a very big squad. Yes, we've got a lot of quality in a lot of positions, in every position, obviously not counting a left back because we don't play with them anymore. But yeah,
what?
I think...
A what?
I know, I've never even heard of it. But yeah, it was tough for Guardiola. Again, not helped by the fact that all of a sudden a few players said that they had niggles. So all of a sudden we were found ourselves in a position where we were having to play Rodri at centre-back and John Stones against Brighton, which if we were being in an ideal situation, neither of those players would have played. So it was a tough one for Guardiola, but ultimately seems like he's managed it well. Yes, we've not won either of the two games since we lifted the trophy, but I wouldn't have traded any of the players' fitness for 3 points in either of those games, that's for sure. So as I said earlier, hopefully we're coming into a situation now where we're in the best possible position to really attack these two games.
Yeah. So with all of that in mind, Joe, can you take anything from the performance at Brentford, or is it just one of those games that it's like watching the final pre-season friendly?
Yeah, that's basically exactly what it is. It feels like Guardiola's kind of used it to get to have like a preview of the players who have been squad players for next season, maybe. Like Calvin Phillips in particular stands out as someone who hasn't really had much game time, but has suddenly found himself with two starts since we've won the title. I think, you know, getting players like him and Rico Lewis, who I think, you know, it's easy to forget was a pretty crucial member of the squad like 3 or 4 months ago, and now he's, you know, just getting these games in at the end of the season. It's almost like he's using it as a chance. Because if anything goes wrong in, say, the first 15, 20 minutes of one of these finals, and one of these players that hasn't really played much because it's effectively been in this crunch time of the season, the same 12, 13 players that have been in the starting 11 pretty much, you know, having these players who we're relying on to come off the bench and change something, or to just slot in if someone gets like an unfortunate injury at the beginning of one of these games, having these players sort of up to speed and match fit rather than just coming off the back of having barely kicked a ball other than the last 15, 20 minutes of games for the last couple of months. I think it's really, you know, beneficial. If Rodri, well, I'm not going to say it, but if something happens with bad,
I was going to say this because like what situation requires Calvin Phillips to come off the bench in one of these games early on? What I was thinking was like if Rodri got injured, then that might happen.
If
but then
Rodri gets injured,
he'd probably put Stones
injured,
there.
Gets injured. Yeah, there's like four players that would have to get injured before Phillips comes on. But I think again, this is kind of looking to next season. I think it maybe gives Guardiola a chance to almost pre-season it, because I think we all know, I think we'll get on to, you know, some transfer rumours that are going on with City at the moment, but I think there's a lot to be said about Calvin Phillips' future at the moment, and these kind of games are giving Guardiola a chance to look at players like him, players like Cole Palmer, and sort of evaluate whether they're players worth hanging around the squad or players that we can maybe look at shifting on. But ultimately, the performance at Brentford, as kind of the same with the performance at Chelsea as well. I mean, we beat Chelsea because Chelsea are hilariously terrible. But at the same time, like if we lose to a team like Brentford, it's not the end of the world. It's not really a damning reflection on the players that we put out there. It's just a squad of players that haven't really played together in that combination much this season at all. It just happened to have not won against a very good team. So, I wouldn't be looking at it with United on the horizon thinking, oh God, we're coming off the back of a defeat. I don't think it'll have any effect on the players that'll be out there at all.
Yeah, and in fairness, I don't think many people are thinking that way either. It's just one of those, like we all see it in the same way. Jordan, I think you used this word before. I think it was you that mentioned the treble. We'll know on Saturday night if it's on. Does that scare you?
Everything scares me, David, to be honest, when it comes to City. Honestly, we could be playing St. Monica's under-12s in the final, and I'd find a way that their number 9 could score against us. That's just the sort of fan that I am, unfortunately. And, you know, I've not even been there through the horrendous times. My first season ticket was just sort of the year before we got decent, when we scored 10 goals at home all season. But, yeah, still I find ways to be pessimistic. But I have been thinking over the last few days and just trying to put it in perspective. And I, like a lot of City fans, grew up in Manchester getting teased about being a Man City fan. And if you'd have offered me a situation where 15, 20 years later, we would be in a position not only to be challenging Man United in the FA Cup final and Inter Milan in the Champions League final, but to be going into those matches as overwhelming favourites, I would have been over the moon. I wouldn't have believed you, and it would have been a dream come true. So as much as it scares me, I think a lot of it as well is to do with the expectation and the narrative around City that we have to win these games. And if we don't, we're bottlers, and Guardiola's legacy won't be cemented at City and we'll never be considered a great team. That's the sort of stuff that gets to me a little bit, as much as it shouldn't.
Well, but what I'll say to that is, like, don't let that get to you, because ultimately, if the argument is that if City don't win the Champions League and FA Cup this season, then they're not a great team, the argument can't also be at the same time that City's dominance is too bad for football. Like, it's not, it's like that. Those two are surely two positions that are completely opposite to each other, and yet you're
underestimate the power of the average football fan, David.
But fair enough. I've just seen narratives all over the place where, like a fortnight ago, we were talking about City's. What is it, 5 titles in 6 seasons now? And people were saying, or you were seeing people say, it's just too much. How can you ever stop City? And then, you know, you listen to us 3 here. If they lose the next 2 finals, they're bottle jobs. It's like, it's like it doesn't add up, does it?
Yeah, to be clear, I wasn't saying that they would be bottle jobs, but the narrative would be. But I totally agree with you. And Joe said, you underestimate the power of the average football fan. I think you underestimate the sort of mainstream media covering City, or a good portion of it, because that will be the narrative. However, I agree with you, it shouldn't affect me, and I have been thinking over the last week or so, just enjoy it. This is a position that every football fan would kill to be in. It is such a privileged position. We are in the middle of the very, very best time to be a City fan, the very, very best time to be a football fan in our lives. So if I can't enjoy an FA Cup final and a Champions League final, then what can I enjoy in football? So yeah, it scares me a little bit because of the reaction. And, you know, I work in sport and work in football, so it's unavoidable for me. But really looking forward to it. And I know how privileged we are to be in this position.
On the reaction side of things, I think the fact that, like you say, because we've won 5 out of 6 Premier Leagues, the Premier League side of thing is becoming a bit like, oh, well, City obviously going to win that now. So I feel like that in a way, as much as we know, and as much as in, you know, 15, 20 years time, people will look back on this team that's won however many leagues in however many years and acknowledge how great it is. I feel like in the immediate aftermath of if we were to lose 1, if not 2 of these finals, I think a large part of it would become like, this is still like, especially if it's a Champions League, a large part of the narrative around City would become they failed at the final hurdle sort of thing. I think, especially with the Pep Champions League thing, I feel like because everyone just sort of goes, well, they've kind of completed English football now. Like, they've done everything. Like, they've won everything. They've won a domestic quadruple. They've won back-to-back-to-back Premier Leagues. If they don't do the Champions League, and as much as we can all sit here and acknowledge how kind of stupid that is, like, the overwhelming narrative will be, it will no longer be how great this season's been for City and how they've brought it back over Arsenal and stuff like that. The narrative will become, oh, Pep and City have failed in Europe again. They'll probably never win it, sort of thing. So for and obviously this isn't about the Champions League, this particular pod, but it's for that reason alone that I just really want us to just stamp that out and just get it over and done with, because that will be the, as much as it shouldn't be, That sadly will be the narrative if it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Jordan, can I put one thing to you, though, in that case? I may argue that football isn't there to be enjoyed during it. I think you kind of have to suffer through it in order to get the enjoyment at the end. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm trying to make myself feel a bit better. I'll be so nervous. I'm going out to Istanbul, and as Joe said, just desperate for us to win the Champions League. And the language that he used stood out to me. And he said, get it over with. And that's how I feel as well. But it's mad that we feel like that, because this is the creme de la creme. This is like, we are the best we will ever be. And we're thinking of it like that. And it's wrong that we should feel like that. But I think that ties into how the point that you've just made, David. Football is a lot of suffering. And you get to enjoy it after, and then a new season starts and everyone forgets about it. But yeah, that's just
exactly that. Yeah. Joe, just on the treble talk as well, how much of that will be motivating United for Saturday? Or is that more of a fan thing, given that, I mean, none of the players that are at United were there 20 years ago. So it's like, it's a previous generation thing.
Yeah, I was having a bit of, this chat with one of my mates a few days ago, funnily enough, when you know the Premier League was over and that, and he sort of got a bit bullish about the idea of the final and stuff and how United will be dead motivated to win it. And I was just thinking, what's Casemiro's tie to the 99 team? Like, he doesn't have one. Like, half the United squad probably wasn't even born when that team won the title. Won the treble, sorry. I feel like it's a bit of a, don't get me wrong, but because of the rivalry and just because of the fact it's City v United, like, if you're a professional footballer and can't get yourself up for that game at Wembley, then quite frankly, you shouldn't be on the pitch. But I don't feel like United's primary motivation will be, our legacy as a club is on the line here, because I don't really think that, I could be completely wrong here, and you know, I'm sure they'll get Fergie in to do like a team talk before.
Just thinking that, yeah.
Fingers crossed he does, given his track record. But like, I think, I think the, you know, I think they'll do that. They'll evoke a lot of that, and maybe, you know, maybe it does work on a few of the players. I'm sure the likes of Rashford, who's obviously, you know, a United boy through and through, he'll have that on his mind. But I don't think the average Manchester United player is really going to be thinking about the treble. They might want to stop City doing the treble in the same way that any club wants to sort of be the team that spoils the party, and they want to stop their local rivals from doing it. But I don't think that'll come from a place of we have to defend United's legacy. I think that will just be a case of these are our local rivals, and these are also currently the best team in the country. It's at Wembley, it's a local derby, like we have to win this sort of thing.
Yeah, we can bloody the nose sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jordan, let's talk a bit about Guardiola and United, because I'm wondering if, do you think Guardiola has a bit of a United problem? His record with City against them, he's played 18, won 9, drawn 2, lost 7. Now, won 9 seems a bit low. Lost 7 seems very high, given the quality of the two teams that they've faced down the years.
Yeah, it does, but I don't think Guardiola has an anyone problem. To be honest, not even a Spurs away problem. It's not his fault we can't stick it in the back of the net there. I think that there's mitigating circumstances for a few of those defeats. I mean, first of all, the one that's just been still makes me sick, because that's, you know, I'm far from someone to complain about referees regularly, but that is the biggest robbery I have seen influenced by officiating in a very long time in a City game, where Rashford was clearly offside and Fernandez stuck it in. Interesting, I've still not heard the VAR audio for that one. But for me, that's a clear mitigating circumstance, because we're on our way to a comfortable 1-0 win there. The other ones have been where we've already won the title, although the one where we could have won it at the Etihad against them and we're 2-0 up still makes me feel a bit queasy.
Still smarts that one, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but it was in between the Liverpool Champions League games as well, and Aguero didn't start. There was some horrendous refereeing in that one by Martin Atkinson, because Ashley Young should have given away a penalty and been sent off for a foul on Aguero. So again, that's another mitigating factor. And also, derbies are a bit like that. Defeats can come from anywhere. I still remember when we beat them at Old Trafford on the anniversary of the Munich air disaster, and everything just said we should have lost that game. You know, similar to how we lost against Liverpool on the anniversary of Hillsborough when Coutinho scored, when we eventually won the title that season. It just felt like that was a game we should lose, and somehow Darius Vassell and Benjani managed to score against a defence of Van der Sar, Neville, Vidic, Ferdinand and Evra. So football's like that, derbies are like that sometimes. But just going back to what you said as well about United wanting to stop the treble, I think that puts a hell of a lot of pressure on them. And I think when you're up against a team as good as City, you don't need added pressure on you. I don't think Fred, as Joe said, Fred, for example, or Ericsson will be running around as Rodri passes it around them for the billionth time going, oh, let's do it for Nicky Butt and Keno. Like, they just don't care like that. It's not how it works. So I'm pretty confident in Pep and pretty confident in the team. Anything can happen in a game of football, but if we go there and play our best, then I don't think we'll have any problems.
Yeah. Joe, I was going to mention some other mitigating factors in those derbies as well, because three of the 7 defeats were in that 2019-20 season where Liverpool ran away with the league and City clearly had a lot of problems. Two of them were when City were practically champions, as Jordan mentioned, the 17-18 where they came back at the Etihad. 2021 where City gave away a penalty in the first 90 seconds or whatever. And then the other one that hasn't been mentioned was the League Cup in Guardiola's first season, where he rotated the team. Does all of that mitigation kind of give him a break, or is there an issue between Guardiola thinking maybe thinking United are better than they are? I don't know.
It kind of feels like he has approached, because I think he's always spoken like very with a lot of reverence to, you know, clubs like Manchester United, like AC Milan. Obviously, he's got the whole Barcelona Real Madrid thing going on. He does respect the quote unquote football heritage of these kind of clubs. And maybe that kind of leads him to go into these games sort of thinking that they are the great teams of old and stuff like that. But also, on the other hand, I do think, I know that Jordan said that Guardiola doesn't really have an anybody problem, but I definitely think he had an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer problem. Like, I think that Solskjaer knew, and it's crazy to say this about someone who was like, we all laughed at quite a lot at his time at United, but for whatever reason, his tactic of that, you know, sitting back and just kind of soaking up possession whilst we were incredibly incapable of scoring goals somehow every single time. And then all it took was for Rashford to go up the other end and just like poke one into a one-on-one. We saw it so many times. And I feel like, obviously, you know, United have probably evolved a little bit from that now. Obviously, they tried to play in a style that's much more similar to us, and we've seen that through a lot of the season. But I kind of feel like it's just that United certainly used to, for a good few years, especially whilst Solskjaer was there, played a specific style of football that is the kind of style of football that we usually see us drop points to. Like it's the kind of style where the team is just going to sit back, pray that we have an off day up front, and then just counter us. And for whatever reason, we had a lot of bad days up front against Manchester United while Solskjaer was there. And I feel like that's kind of all it's really come down to. Based on the performances we put in against Manchester United this season, and bearing in mind that the one with the insane decision at Old Trafford earlier this season, I was listening to a podcast earlier today where they mentioned that actually that result came pre this John Stones hybrid centre-back, centre-midfield kind of thing, which has now been the reason why we've obviously gone and had such a brilliant end to the season. So it'll be interesting to see if Manchester United can deal with that. So I'm kind of, basically, we've played our best football since the time that United did defeat us. And obviously the defeat itself, as Jordan's mentioned, had like the horrendous mitigation of that just insane goal that I don't think I'll ever see repeated again in the Premier League. And yeah, it's just, we should on paper, and it's really jinxy to say this, but we should be going into this feeling very confident. And whether there's been some kind of issues with United in the past, I don't think they've really been there this season since Ten Hag's taken over.
Yeah, well, you jinx away, my friend, and we'll see what happens.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Jordan, that old tactic, United basically conceding possession and then have a lot of good players who can hit City on the break. Is that still relevant if Anthony's injured and Martial's injured? Is this all playing into City's hands?
Well, you said you jinx away, so I'm going to be wary of saying yeah, but I don't know. I think you can look at it a couple of ways. Martial, for me, seems to have only had good games against City since his breakout season. So I was quite relieved to see Martial as injured. It means that Rashford is likely to play down the middle, and it might actually benefit United in that it gives Ten Hag an excuse to play Fernandes on the left and play a midfield three of Fred, Casemiro and Eriksen and just sit back. So I think you can look at it like that, or you could look at it as Rashford is going to be their sole outlet. It means that if Pep wants to, there's not as much of a onus or temptation to play Kyle Walker, because that is a bit of a debate, which we'll come on to, I'm sure, as to what we do with Akanji and Ake if Ake's fully fit. So I'm not really sure whose hands it plays into more and who it benefits more, but ultimately we're going into the game with a fully fit squad, basically, and they're not. I don't think it really changes their tactics too drastically, but it just means that Rashford is going to be through the middle rather than on the wing. And I think I would prefer that to be the case, personally.
Yeah. Well, looking at Guardiola at Wembley as well, Joe. So his overall record at Wembley, this is including games where he was manager away from City, is played 17, won 12, lost 5. So if he has a bit of an issue with United, he certainly doesn't at Wembley. Because in those 5 losses, they include Liverpool and Chelsea in the FA Cup semi-finals, where he rotated the teams. Also a much rotated side for the Leicester Community Shield in 2021. And then the other two are Arsenal FA Cup semi-finals 2020, when things weren't quite right anyway with the team, and then in that first season, which took extra time for Arsenal to go on and beat them. So at Wembley, Guardiola was pretty good.
Yeah, it's kind of like the cup finals thing with Guardiola, isn't it? It's just he's got just a generally very good record in finals, full stop. I think he's only lost, was it only the Champions League final that he's lost? I think he's won against Chelsea. I think he's won every other cup final that he's been in. That's just off the top of my head. I could be completely wrong. But yeah, it's, you know, it feels like when it comes to these crunch games, as much as certainly in the past, we've had a lot of games where we've looked at the squad that Pep Guardiola's put out there and thought, oh God, there's something really weird here when it comes to a big game. You know, a large majority of the time, it seems to work. And I think we're at the point where certainly with the team that we've got now and with the results that we've seen over the last, like, you know, the last 15 or so games, I think we're at a point, obviously, you know, excluding the ones we've won since the title win, I feel like we've got a pretty settled team that we should really be seeing start both in for the most part. Surely about 9 or 10 of the starting 11 should be basically identical for the two games we've got coming up. But yeah, it's when it gets to this crunch point where it's, you know, semi-finals and finals, he just knows how to get over the line, particularly in finals. And again, I'm doing so much jinxing here in this podcast, but yeah, I'm just saying there's a lot of reasons to feel confident because of that. Yeah, I would be shocked if we see, you know, a really wild start in 11, but I think that record at Wembley usually comes down to the fact that we go into it a lot of the time favourites, and obviously you can always have a Wigan moment, but usually the team that is, you know, the team that is on is the favourite will be the one that comes out on top.
Yeah, well, let's look at possible selections to finish the first part of the show, Jordan. You've talked about Kyle Walker before. Let's get into the Ake situation. I played for just over an hour against Brentford. Not entirely sure how much of that was through necessity or the fact that City wanted him on the pitch. Would you like him back in, or would you be perfectly happy with Akanji at left back? And I mean, how that affects the rest of the defence, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's been made more of a dilemma by how good Kyle Walker was against Vinicius, against Real Madrid, because for me, our best starting 11 contains the four centre-backs as the defenders, you know, Akanji on the right or Stones, whoever it is, one of those two, and Diaz and Ake on the left. So I think I'm leaning more towards, now that we know Martial's injured and I don't think he's starting Weghorst, so it's likely Rashford will be through the middle. I think, as I said, it takes away the pressure to play Walker. And if Ake is fully fit, and I think Guardiola gave him 60 just to give him the minutes because he wants him ready for the next two games, my preferred choice will be Akanji, Stones, Diaz and Ake.
Yeah. A bit further forward, Joe, De Bruyne and Haaland were both rested for Brentford. Hopefully just tired, but obviously, I mean, when De Bruyne has had niggles in the past, it's not necessarily been the quickest one to come back.
Yeah, I'm hoping that those two in particular was just literally because of the number of games that they've played. I mean, they did get the odd one or two out during that sort of run that's took us to the title win and, you know, the Champions League games as well. They have had the odd one or two games where they've been dropped, but I'm hoping that this last couple of weeks has more to just been to let their bodies reset from this incredible sort of number of games they've had to play back to back to back. I mean, I know Haaland in particular is someone who the club really, really closely keep an eye on in terms of like his fitness and stuff like that. I think the regime that they've got him under is mad. So I think, yeah, certainly with those two in particular, they're the kind of ones who you want to keep wrapped in cotton wool right up until the point where you know you definitely need them. And yeah, the last couple of weeks has been cotton wool time. So hopefully this is the point where we can have them very much, you know, fully fit and ready to go.
Yeah, got to get the colour back out of De Bruyne's face, haven't you? Just to, just cool him down. Any worries, Jordan, about Haaland and his, I was going to say his recent form. The man's broken Premier League records left, right and centre, but you know what I mean? He missed a few chances in the last couple of games.
Well, I might have said yes, actually, if we were doing this podcast yesterday, but get ready for a big name drop because for podcast at work, we actually spoke to Haaland yesterday. And it was done by Dan Rowan, the BBC Sport editor. And he asked Haaland about his mentality and how not scoring goals affects him. And what Haaland said was, I don't think of it as a goal drought. I think of it as the next game, I'm just more likely to score because how long am I actually going to go on a goal drought for? And that reassured me, really, because thinking he's missed quite a few chances over the last few games. His last goal was against Everton, wasn't it? And we've played a few since then. And you just think the longer it goes on, the more he snatches at chances, and any normal human being would suffer in confidence. But he's not a normal human being, and his mentality is definitely that. And it's true, isn't it? Like, is Haaland going to go on a 6-7 game goal drought? I don't think so. I can't see that being the case. I wouldn't put money on it, that's for sure. I'm not worried about him. He scored 52 goals in all competitions this season, and it wouldn't surprise me if he's saving his best bit of form for the two games of the season, which could cement our place in football and history.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just Googling hat-tricks in FA Cup finals just to see who's done it before.
Do you think the fact that obviously he broke the goal scoring record then kind of, because it was that game against, was it the game against Everton where he broke it, where he got the actual official record and he's not scored? No, he has scored since.
I think it was against West Ham where he scored his 35th goal of the season.
That's the one, yeah. But it feels like since then he's not really, do you think mentally maybe he's sort of, the pressure's off because he hasn't got that thing to chase anymore, so he's kind of just been not really as on it as a result? I don't know.
Yeah,
it seems weird to say that about Haaland, who obviously doesn't strike me as someone who has that mentality, but I feel like in the cups in particular, where that isn't really a factor, like you've got a trophy on the line if you score goals, like I feel like that will, if that can't be what sort of fires him up. Obviously Haaland, we saw in the beginning of the season, he scored a hat-trick against United, didn't he? So I'm really hoping he does something like that again. But I'm thinking maybe the last few weeks of form from him has maybe just been because it feels a bit like job done with the title wrapped up and with the Premier League record secured. It feels like maybe from his point of view, it's been a bit like, well, I've done that for this season now. Now it's sort of all focus on the FA Cup and Champions League, maybe.
That'd be nice, but I don't think it's the case. I think it's a mixture of other things, really. He should have scored against Real, but as much as he should have scored the first chance, I think the second one, the save from Courtois, was one of the saves of the season.
Ridiculous.
One of the best saves I've ever seen live. So, you know, if it was anyone else in net, mind you, De Gea is probably capable of a save like that. But if it any standard keeper, that would have been a goal, and we probably wouldn't be discussing it because he'd have contributed to another big European win. I don't think it's really phasing him because, let's remember as well, he played against Brighton, and if he was snatching at chances and worried about scoring goals, he would have shot when he went clean through. But he took his time, laid it off to Foden. No dramas. So I honestly think he's chilled out. I really do think he's a team player. And I've got no doubt that, again, from having listened to him yesterday, I just don't think it phases him like it does any other normal human being.
I think that's a big factor as well, isn't it? That ultimately he's been playing really well. Like everything he does, like outside of scoring a goal, everything he does is still really good. So it's not like he's been genuinely like off the boil, like such a poor player for a while. He just hasn't scored for a few games, and that's all it really comes down to, isn't it? So I think
and he still contributes with the ball as well. His all round play is excellent. It's certainly not the case that if he doesn't score, then what's the point in having him? Because that was the narrative earlier in the season. But I actually think his best all-round display for City was the 4-1 against Arsenal, and he missed a shed load of chances in that, and eventually got his goal when he let his man bun down. But he was brilliant with the ball at his feet that day. And yeah, I just think as well, we've got other goal scoring options. There's not that much pressure on him to back. It's not beyond the realms of possibility, is it, that we win the next two games and Haaland doesn't score in either of them, because we've got Kevin De Bruyne, absolutely. We've got Gundogan, Grealish can chip in. Bernardo scored 2 against Real Madrid. Like, I'm just not worried about it, because he's still contributing well to our play.
Yeah. 3 hat-tricks in FA Cup finals previously, 1890, 1894 and 1953. So all I'm going to say, we are due one.
I just ask, did Raheem Sterling not score one against Watford?
It was taken off him, wasn't it? Jesus got the final touch, yeah.
Because it just went over the line, okay.
Yeah, so he didn't quite get it, but yeah, I was sitting here thinking that I'm sure Sterling, or the other way around, I'm sure Jesus got it, but Sterling took it or one way or the other. But no, whichever one it was got 2, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Sterling that got 2 and like, just banged it in on the line, didn't he? Yeah. Anyway, Joe, can you name the other 2?
you're putting my knowledge joking, of 1890.
No, we're joking. The other question then, Jordan, you mentioned it about the other players that might be the goal threat. Is it 2 from 4 basically for Guardiola to pick around Mahrez, Bernardo, Grealish, and Foden?
Mahrez, Bernardo, Grealish. Yeah, I guess so. I mean that those are our winger options, and I think Gundogan, even though he didn't start at Old Trafford when we lost in January. I think he's really shown his importance in the closing stages of the season. If it needed underlining, his role in the running has been spectacular. And therefore, I can't see Bernardo playing centrally unless there is anything more wrong with De Bruyne. So yeah, it's a question of whether he wants to stick with the team who have beaten Bayern Munich home and away and Real Madrid. We drew at Bayern, didn't we? Anyway, yeah, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
Saw off Bayern Munich and saw off Real Madrid. So that would be Bernardo and Grealish. I do think that Foden and Mahrez have been pretty good in the run-in. I thought Mahrez was excellent against Everton. Got the assist for Gundogan's opener and also did score a hat-trick in the FA Cup semi-final against Sheffield United. And I think Phil looks like the old Phil. He looks like he's having fun with it. So yeah. I don't think I'm not sure I've got a preference. I think Grealish has to start. I think Grealish definitely should start. And then...
So maybe not 2 from 4, just, maybe 1 from 3 then in that case.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Sorry to throw the maths everywhere though. It can be difficult to work out the maths sometimes.
That's all right. I was better at English, that's why.
I think if Grealish starts, that kind of rules out Foden, doesn't it, really? We haven't really seen much of him on the right this season when he has played. So it kind of, at that point, becomes you're picking between Bernardo and Mahrez for the other side. Did Foden play on the right against them in the 6-3?
That's exactly what I was going right to say. He scored a hat-trick from the right in the 6-3. So, I think Phil's good on the right. I think he's great anywhere. I wouldn't mind any combination, really. Well, that's a lie, because I've just said Grealish has to play. Yeah, any of the 3 on the right, I'd be content with.
I'll tell you what, it's a fucking good job we're not having to pick this team at weekend. the state of us 3 here. Final question then, Joe. How important is Ilkay Gundogan going to be for this game?
If he continues the same sort of form that we've seen from him in this last month, then he's got a game to almost win on his own at this point. I think he's almost more important in a lot of ways than De Bruyne has been in the last month or so. Because as much as De Bruyne is obviously the player that everyone looks towards, and in a massive game, De Bruyne has got a goal in him, like we saw in the Arsenal game, and he's also got the assists that we saw against and goals that we saw against Madrid. But Gundogan just has that as well. I mean, we all know the goals that he scored this season, the goals that he scored last season in the Aston Villa game and things like that. Yeah, I think if these last two games are going to potentially be his swan song, as he's, we don't know whether he's going to sign a new deal or not, then, what better way to go out than to smash United in the FA Cup final when you're, as your last game in England?
Yeah, be nice to see him lift that trophy again, wouldn't it, John? I mean, two more trophy lifts from him before, if he is to leave, would be perfect, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't want him to leave, so it wouldn't be quite perfect. But yeah, he's just been so good in the running, and it's really sort of cemented. Not that it really needed cementing after the Aston Villa comeback at the end of last season, but it has just clearly shown his importance over his 7 years at the club. I mean, you look back at some of the title wins as well. He was our top scorer in the first of the most recent three title wins, which is crazy for a number eight. He's, you know, he scored on the final day at Brighton in the 18-19 season, didn't he, with that free kick to cement that title. Playing
He played as a six for most of that season, didn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, Fernandinho was injured and he was brilliant stepping in, because that was a time when we had no Fernandinho replacement. And yeah, the Aston Villa one at the end of last season is, if the Aguero moment doesn't exist, that's the greatest moment in Premier League history. And he's just been fantastic for us over the last couple of months. So good. He really is an unsung hero of this City team. And the goal against Everton to just take all the pressure and the sting out of that game was vital. And basically, I think that win against Everton led to Arsenal's head dropping, because I think they lost to Brighton, didn't they, after that?
Yeah, so, that evening, yeah.
Yeah, he's been fantastic and he deserves all the plaudits. And I think in years to come, if he does leave the club, we will put him on a Yaya Toure, maybe even David Silva level of importance to the club and Aguero. I don't see why not. He's maybe not as flashy as those players, and he came a little bit later when he was surrounded by more top and big names. But as I said, he has been so important to us over his 7 years at the club. And what a bargain, eh? What was it, 16 million in Pep's first signing?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time to put your money where your mouth is for the United game. We remain on £1,015 for the season on the charity bet so far. We've got two more chances to increase that total between now and the end of the season. We'll be previewing the Champions League final on next week's show, which means we've got just the FA Cup final to predict here. Each of us gets a £10 correct score single from William Hill. The winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're helping the Trussell Trust fight poverty in Manchester. So, it's United at Wembley. What are we thinking for this one? Jordan, where are you going for this?
Going 2-0 City. I think we, if we play to our best, we've got no problems.
2-0 City, nice and comfortable. 7-1, £70 if you are right. I'm going a little bit more uncomfortable with a 2-1 City win, which is 15-2 and £75. That leaves us with Joe. What are you having?
I'm going 3-1. I think, yeah, similarly uncomfortable, but I have a feeling that like a very late third goal will make it slightly less uncomfortable for the final 5-10 minutes or so.
Well, if it goes that way, 11-1 and £110 if you are right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And to get more information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now, just before we move on, since we now know when the end of the season is going to be, we can announce that the Blue Moon Podcast Live is coming back to Manchester for the final show of this current series. We'll be back at Idle Hands Coffee on Dale Street in Manchester, and it's going to be on the evening of Wednesday, the 14th of June. I'll be hosting. There'll be the usual panel of guests, and I'm still trying to nail down an ex-player to join us. I've got a good idea of who it's going to be, but we're just still waiting to check that there's no diary clashes before we announce it. Tickets are £2.50 each, plus a small booking fee. There's only a limited number, and every penny of your £2.50 is going to be donated to the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group as well. So come and enjoy the show however the season ends. Details on how to get tickets, they're on our Twitter feed, at Blue Moon Podcast. You can also buy tickets by going to bmp2023.eventbrite.com. That's bmp2023.eventbrite.com. Now then, at this point in the season, now that the title has been won and with City in two more finals in the next two weekends, we'd like to take a moment to remember the times where we were perhaps panicking a little bit too much over nothing. It's time for the bad take amnesty. No previous opinion is too silly or too stupid, but equally, it's all done in the knowledge that things turned out all right this season again. I was joined by Chris Higginbottom and first Dom Farrell to discuss some terrible hot takes throughout this tour.
I've been rifling through some of the stuff I've written this year, and there was definitely one about Raheem Sterling making Chelsea's stronger and City weaker, but we'll probably move on to that particular topic. But kind of keen to hear yours to kick us off, David.
Yeah, I thought this might be the case. I'll tell you what, I'll read my tweet from the 14th of January, directly after City had just lost the derby at Old Trafford. And I tweeted a thread that started with, "Made my peace with the season today. I think at the halfway point, City don't have the consistency to keep up with Arsenal. And even if they were to take 6 points off them, they'll drop more points elsewhere. I'm kind of all right with it if it's Arsenal top and City second. It doesn't feel like City will win 10 to 15 on the spin."
Ah, good to be wrong, isn't it?
It's incredibly good to be wrong. But I mean, how wrong is that? I mean, I remember getting like several emojis in reply from people. You know that emoji that's just got one eyebrow lifted?
The Carlo Ancelotti.
So I got a few people just kind of sending that as if I was the one that was barking mad. But honestly, Dom, tell me I'm like that. It was a fair comment at the time, wasn't it? Surely.
Oh yeah, totally was. I mean, I remember saying to someone at the time that the thing about those big long winning runs is they have to start after a game you've not won by the very necessity of how you measure them. And so you never look like you're going to go on one of those runs until they actually happen. But yeah, before the big run that won the league, hadn't City only won three in succession all season? So yeah, it was fair enough. And like I say, there is a little bit of rewriting history at the moment, isn't there? Of like, it's inevitable. City were always going to do that. It's like, well, not really. Not if you were watching him in January, it wasn't inevitable. But yeah, I think you can argue with nothing that you said in that tweet at the time, but right now it is obviously hilarious.
It looks like a terrible take, doesn't it? Chris, are you, like, after that Manchester derby, did you at any point throw in the towel on this season, or are you going to tell me now that you were perfectly, you know, behind the lads all the way?
Well, I mean, taking the Manchester derby, I was about to throw the towel in with football, considering the mid-game rule change that was implemented. I mean, what the hell was all that about? That's the only way they could have beat us is by reinventing the offside rule, and they pulled it off. I mean, yeah, I was absolutely resigned to not winning the league. I was formulating congratulation, you know, gritted teeth, congratulatory speeches to Arsenal fans, and completely written it off. I mean, it's ridiculous to say, when people say it was inevitable when City winning league, even when we have been winning it, it's been by the skin of our teeth. So to win it with three games to spare was just absolute lunacy. I can't understand quite how it's happened. I don't think Arsenal can either, to be honest.
Yeah, well, let's move away from my embarrassment. I'll chuck in this from LFGM on Twitter, who, again, after the Manchester derby, said City didn't deserve anything from that. Unless they win the FA Cup, this is going to be Pep's worst season at City. Major changes are needed. The squad needs to be revamped. Again, after that derby, that was what they were thinking, Chris. And here we are, like, as we record this, City have the chance of achieving the treble.
Oh, we're going to go there.
Yeah, we're going there.
We're going to mention it. We're treading into Jinxville with our heads held high, are we? I don't know. I mean, I don't like to... These one-off games, they say anything can happen in a derby, form goes out the window, and a cup final, it's a one-off game. I am cacking it, if I'm honest. And it makes it worse that there's so much bravado doing the rounds. Everyone's like, oh, it's going to be a cakewalk. We're going to Mully United. We're going to steamroller into Milan. I'll be very, very, very surprised if we do the T word.
Okay.
Having said that, I didn't say that about the league.
Yeah, this is a bad take amnesty. I don't know if you can make a take on a bad take amnesty and then it be part of the amnesty. Does that count? I don't know.
It's like bad takes like squared, isn't it? Like, yeah. I don't know. I'm ladling
it. Through the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other bad takes from you two before we get some from the audience? Chris, have you said anything throughout the season where you look back now and think, why did I say that?
A couple of things, yeah. I mean, well, loads, but if we're just keeping it to football, I mean, Akanji, I was calling him Akanji at one point. I said he was built like a porta cabin on the turning circle of the QE2. Wasn't good enough. we're never going to win anything with him in the team. I was basically saying to people, you wait, he's going to make an absolutely crucial mistake that will cost us the league. And he has been, basically since I started slagging him off, I'm not trying to take the credit, but just to amplify how much of a bad take it was, as soon as I started saying it, he's just been absolutely superb. I don't think he's put a foot wrong. He seems to go more confident. He seems to go more pacey and athletic and deft with each game. It's absolutely phenomenal. The way he's just cemented that place in the team and the progress he's made. Like, what an absolute hero. Yeah.
He's no Otamendi, is he?
Well, thankfully, no. As much as I've got a lot of admiration for Otamendi, he was a bit of a liability at times. But he's been nothing but dependable and strong. And every time he goes up against an opponent that you think, bloody hell, he's going to be in trouble there, he just pockets him.
Yeah.
Can you imagine anyone more temperamentally different to Akanji than Otamendi? It's like, I can't imagine Otamendi sitting down and working on the old long division and stuff, can you? It's like, they're different breeds then too.
Is long division a skill that Akanji has, or is it just multiplication? Can he do it backwards?
Let's get some pre-Champions League final questions in for the lads. I'll make a note. But if he is a porter cabin, like Chris said, he could calculate the internal cubic volume of himself just like that. No time, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Otamendi would slide tackle a porter cabin and absolutely ruin it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Give away a penalty in the process. Dom, you mentioned the Sterling take. He possibly did make Chelsea stronger, but there was an absolute shit show going on around him. Is that a possibility?
Do you know what? Because unfortunately, I have to delve out of the world of Bert for work, and Sterling isn't even my worst Chelsea take, although this one is a bit of a caveat. I said that Aubameyang was a really good signing, but that was because he was perfect with Thomas Tuchel and then ended sack Tuchel a week later. So that's a terrible take. But I think half the blame is on Todd Bowley for that one.
Yeah.
I think I was looking back through some. It's always great to do look back at things you've written through the season that are like, well, bollocks. But there is a City flavour to this that it's probably in our sort of DNA to overestimate Tottenham. You know, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
So at the start of the season, when they started pretty well, and I'd say Kulusevski had some great games against City this year before. And the whole Liverpool front three had ended because Mane had left, and I did a piece on how Kulusevski, Son and Kane were going to be the new it front three in the Premier League. They were the best front three in the league. So, and to sort of bring it full circle handily, after I was covering Leeds against Tottenham at the weekend on the last day of the Premier League season, and Kulusevski came to do some mix zone, and I've got his stats here, after he played 30 games this season in the Premier League and scored twice. So there he was. I was speaking to the man I'd said was going to be one of the best forwards in the league.
Excellent.
Got 2 goals in 30. So that would, I think that's my piping hottest, Spursiest take going.
Excellent. Well, we asked the audience for some of their hot takes throughout the season. We'll run through some of them now. Let's start with Andy, who didn't give us one of his own, but he absolutely threw Nader Manua under the bus because he said at the start of the season, Nader picked Liverpool to win the league with Spurs finishing third. And I sat there and thought, could we do this on this bit of the podcast? I thought, yeah, we can. But we've got to give the man a right of reply, haven't we? So I asked Nadim what he thought about that take, and this is what he said.
Right. So firstly, big shout out to Andy for being drawn in by that bit of media bait that the BBC did. Okay. So a few things. Yes, I did predict that Liverpool would be first and that Spurs would be third. But just think about this for a second, yeah? How would it seem if me, the former Man City guy, said City are going to win the league, they're going to win the FA Cup, win the Carabao Cup, win the Champions League? People are like, well, of course you'd say that because you're associated with Man City. So what I do for content is put certain things out that might make sense. And if they don't work out and say City win the league, well, I guess I win either way. So do not get too drawn in by that, my friend. And it's also nice every so often to just dangle a carrot out, because when these predictions come out, you've got very, very, very active fan bases waiting to tell you how stupid you are for your prediction. And let's be clear, if I was good at predicting things, I think I'd rather be good at predicting the lottery, because then you wouldn't find me doing football predictions for much longer. How about that?
That is true, isn't it, Dom? There's no, like, there's just no value in football predictions.
Yeah, Manuel Akanji will tell you it's statistically harder to predict the lottery, though. So
yeah, fair play, fair point. Let's rattle through a few others. Andy says, I was adamant that Cancelo would stay and Walker would leave this season. Chris, I don't think any of us saw Cancelo leaving in January, but maybe Walker out hasn't been that far away. He's not been that in the team recently.
I think that's really good man management by Pep. He publicly slated him a bit. He's left him out in a part of the season where evidently he could afford to, and he's brought him in at the tasty end where he's coming with a real point to prove. He's had a bit of a rest, so he's, you know, firing on all cylinders, and he's been absolutely amazing. He's playing as well as he's ever played, I would say. So yeah, I don't think he was close to leaving, but he'd been left out, and the results of that have been reaped by Walker and the rest of the team. As for Cancelo,
he's got two winners medals this season.
Know, yeah, and I don't think anyone on either team wants him to have either of them. He seems like a bit of a knob, but he's doing all right for himself. How we're going to have to sell him, aren't we? Who are we selling him to?
I don't know.
I mean, as Tip Boogly or whatever he's called at Chelsea, has he like got any spare cash? Hasn't he got to sell like 30 players by the end of June?
Yeah, that won't stop
otherwise,
him bringing some more
like
in though, yeah.
Go and buy a baseball club and walk into the sunset with his Stetson held high.
Yeah, I don't know. Rob Wilson, Dom, said, I thought Alvarez was going to be a CFG signing. In fairness, there was talk at the start of the season, wasn't there, that City were assessing where he'd be. I don't think any of us really expected him to then finish the season with a World Cup winners' medal, having played a key part in Argentina's team and having scored some of the crucial best goals that City have scored this season.
Yeah, when City make those sort of signings, it's where on the Gabriel Jesus, Marlos Moreno spectrum are you? And I think obviously Julian Alvarez is an incredible talent, he's right off way beyond the Jesus end of it. Yeah, he's been brilliant. I mean, like still working at the MEN in January when like the deal was sorted out, and we did loads of like sort of just digging around. Like everyone looked good on goal montages, but looking at all like the really really Argentinian forward goals he'd scored for River Plate, and like I remember like being excited by that. But then I remembered when I was years before, I was really excited by the Georgia Samaras YouTube compilation. Thankfully, Alvarez is more closer to real life, and yeah, he's been amazing.
Yeah, we were all stung by that, weren't we? Another one for you, Dom. John Hay says, I thought getting rid of Sterling and Jesus was a mistake and Alvarez wouldn't contribute bar a couple of cup goals. Our second highest scorer with the World Cup in the bag, starting with Messi and an Abby Hay ultra. Apologies, I got it massively wrong. So we've covered Alvarez. Sterling and Jesus leaving. That was, I must admit, that worried me at the start of the season.
Yeah, but I think it was also the right time for both of them, wasn't it, really? And I think, I mean, this is harsh because I like Gabriel Jesus, but I think, and he did an awful lot for City, and he's a player with plenty of, like, big attributes to enhance any team he's in. But I think when you look at his goals return or lack of it in the running, he kind of has always had that in his locker as well, hasn't he? And it does say it. When some people have said the thing of like, you know, Sterling, Jesus out and Haaland and Alvarez in. Obviously, it wasn't a straight swap. And it can be a bit disingenuous to talk about it like that. But at the same time, it looks like City have got the best end of that equation, doesn't it?
Yeah. Was there at any point, Chris, you felt in the season that it was going to come back to bite City? Jesus and Zinchenko was the other one where people were saying, you know, we've strengthened Arsenal too much here.
100%. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought early doors, naive idiot that I am. I mean, you look at the contribution Zinchenko made to us. I don't think Gundogan was winning us the league without that little bit of work from Zinchenko. And didn't he set Rodri up as well for that 20-yard side foot daisy cutter?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, really, really valuable player for us. He's been great, but again, you know, you can't, in terms of the right time to leave for Jesus, it was the right time for Zinchenko to leave from his point of view, because he wasn't starting every game. He knew he was probably going to continue in much the same vein, i.e. not an automatic choice, wants to go somewhere where he would be, and he was, and they were doing really well. And I think the point at which I thought, yeah, maybe he's not quite got the mentality that I maybe even thought he had when he was doing, Arsenal conceded a goal and he was doing a little on-the-pitch team talk, and it just didn't really look all that convincing. And
yeah, compensating much.
Yeah, the players he was kind of trying to motivate who were towering over him, kind of looking disinterestedly into the middle distance, and I was like, oh yeah, they don't really seem to be respecting him. It's not going to work, this, is it? And yeah, we've pulled away, and all the decisions seem to have favoured us. It's just ridiculous how it's happened.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
This is from a Twitter user called Say What You See, and it was at 2-0 at half-time in the Spurs home game. They said, Pepe's trying to change the gearbox while we're still on the motorway, and sadly this is the result. If he continues, I think this season is a write-off. Will he make big changes at half-time? I'm not sure. And then they replied to that tweet at full-time with just the phrase, I'll get my coat. Chris, that's a nice little fast show reference there.
Yeah, I love a bit of fast show. He does that though, doesn't he, Pep? He's not afraid to tinker mid-season. He's normally afraid to make big changes in a game, but if you 2-0 down at half-time to Spurs, then that's the time to do it, really. I think, when are we going to stop questioning Beanhead and his genius? He just seems to make the calls correctly all the time, and here we are questioning him like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah, knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Seems to.
Sandy Rush on Twitter said, in October 2022, Cancelo had turned a corner in his defensive play and he was spending the rest of his career at City. Obviously, that didn't go to plan. He also said, John Stones at right back was an abomination and Grealish was never going to fit in at City. Dom, two cornerstones of City's season, certainly in the latter half, has been Grealish's form and John Stones at right back.
That's a belter, isn't it? I don't think Cancelo will ever turn a corner defensive play. He's just away with the fairies, isn't he, half the time. Yes, Stones, sort of the mad thing about Stones in midfield, right back, centre back, all the positions he's playing all at once at the moment, is he has, you know, to sort of cut Sandy some slack there. Stones has definitely played in those positions in previous seasons and it has looked clunky and horrible. And as regards Grealish, I mean, I guess it was how long people wanted to keep the faith in, because a lot of people were going, oh, the second season with Pep. And then he started this season a bit slowly, but obviously since the World Cup, he's been another level. He's been, you know, the most consistent attacking creative player, probably. Obviously, guys like De Bruyne have bigger moments and things, but I think from January onwards, you've just not been able to fault him. You know what you're going to get every time. And like, I think if you'd said to people 12 months ago, City are going to be in a Champions League final and Jack Grealish is a guaranteed starter if fit, I don't think many people would have believed that. And I think that says everything you need to know about everything he's done this year.
Maybe they should have got him that Home Alone tour a bit earlier. Maybe that was the thing that he needed to do just before Christmas to spark his form off.
Man, yeah, that was the catalyst, wasn't it? Yeah, the Home Alone 2 is amazing. I think Home Alone 2 is maybe even controversially better than the first one, so fair play to Jack for doing his pilgrimage.
Yeah, bad take, Amnesty. Again, not the place for takes like that. I'm not sure we can allow it. Darren on Twitter said, agreed with you, Chris. Akanji wasn't good enough for us. Bad Contract Dog also said, I was very critical of Akanji earlier in the season, especially after Brighton, Liverpool and Brentford. Thought he was awful in those games, mostly due to a lack of effort, which to me is unforgivable. But I've got to give him props. He's been great in the second half of the season. So again, Chris, that just speaks to exactly what you were saying about Akanji.
Yeah, I mean, he did look clunky, chunky, and I can't be arsed and giving it a third rhyme.
I can't think of anything that rhymes with that.
And not very hunky. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm struggling as well.
Potentially flunky. Anyway, he didn't look that good, did he? Now he does. I mean, I don't know how that works. But going back to John Stones, he just looks like the most sublime footballer I've ever seen at the moment. It must be rubbing off on Akanji. We can credit maybe Stones with that as well. Just give all the credit to John Stones. He's in every song we sing. He's in every position we play. And he needs to be starting every game.
Yeah. Let's take this from Brian, who said, City made a mistake not selling Ake to Chelsea in the summer, Dom.
Well, I mean, I can see why people thought Ake was like the guy that was good scoring. I sort of a parallel bad take out of myself at the start of the season. I thought that, like, you had Laporte and Stones and Diaz were clearly the top three centre backs, and Ake was like a distant fourth who would never get into that. But again, if he's fit, he plays. He's been fantastic. So yeah, I think it's kind of with all these things. And maybe this is going to result in more, your bad take on this is going to get more boring as the Pep era goes on and on, is you've kind of just got, you know, you've got to trust that he signed good players who will eventually know what to do and it all works out fine. And, you know, maybe that's boring, but yeah.
Stop having takes, then we don't need an amnesty, yeah.
I mean, indisputably for about, you know, pretty much for the whole second half of the season, Ake has been picked ahead of Emery at Laporte and no one's had a problem with it. I mean, could you have imagined that a year ago? It's, yeah. I don't think it was necessary.
It's so sad to see him go.
It is, but it's been an incredible turnaround for Ake. But again, it's testament to Guardiola and how he develops players. And if you're a player and you buy into what Pep wants to do, then sky's the limit, really.
Yeah.
This is it. How much of these bad takes are just Pep recognising what is going wrong? So at the time, it's a good take, it's an accurate take, and Pep's just
fixed it.
Turning round, yeah, he's just fixing stuff. He's just getting hold of these players, identifying the errors, or he is looking at things where maybe he's not identified what's going to happen in games that have exposed players, and he's shoring up those, you know, plugging those holes in the system where, well, if I leave Ake in this position to receive the ball here and this player's here and this player's here, then this will happen, it'll get overrun. So I will now never allow that to happen, and just takes the team, drills a revised sort of shape into them in training. And that's why we're looking at players going, wow, this guy's improved 80% in the last four games. How is that possible? It's just Pep, isn't it, I think? Yeah. He's just a genius.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe the bad takes are actually directly responsible for it, because we know Pep's on Twitter all the time, so he's probably read most of these anyway.
Yeah, that's true. There we are. Actually, we'll take the credit for them.
So it's down to us.
Yeah, well done, everyone.
They're catalysts, they're not bad takes.
Yeah, exactly that. I'm going to finish with this one from my mate Kev, who is a Wolves fan, who saw the tweet, saw me post it and said, not betting on this will haunt me forever. And then there was a screenshot of a bet that said Erling Haaland to score more Premier League goals than Wolves, 14-1. Haaland finished on 36, Wolves finished on 31.
Yeah, he's had a howler there.
Get Kev on for some bets next season, because it'd be as bad as I am at predicting outcomes and stuff.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
Chris Higginbottom and Dom Farrell chatting through some of the worst takes around City this season. I'm not letting you two get away with this. Joe, have you got anything that you'd like to bring to the amnesty?
I've got four. I couldn't pick between which one was. So I'll quickly go through them all. There's one of them I retweeted, a Zinchenko interview saying genuinely one of the biggest mistakes of the Pep era to sell this guy. And needless to say, I think his emotional instability has probably sort of epitomised Arsenal's downfall since then. The other one was when we went 1-0 down against Liverpool at Anfield, saying we're just so shit when we play against this lot. We can do whatever we want going the other way, but there's always a stupid goal to give up. I'm not sure how wrong that is, actually, but we didn't win 4-1 in the end, so it turned out all right. Yeah. The other one, another Liverpool-related one, was at Anfield earlier this season. After the team news was announced, I said, if Liverpool beat this team, then you've just got to hold your hands up and say that our team is full of spineless cowards who bottled it and we lost 1-0. And then during the Brentford game, after Laporte was what can only be described as giving a wrestling move in the penalty area and no penalty was given. I said, never thought I'd say this, but can we have Mike Dean back, which might be the worst of the four. So, yeah, I've done a lot of terrible takes. There's probably hundreds more, but yeah, I didn't want to have too much to feel bad about.
Yeah. Jordan, anything you'd like to get off your chest from this season?
I quite enjoy my bad takes, to be honest, because usually they're criticising City players. So when they're wrong, it's sort of a win-win. Like, you know, great. The majority of my bad takes have been around the defensive situation, because I distinctly remember myself describing Ruben Diaz as our fifth choice centre-back early on in the season, which has been shown to be absolute rubbish. Pretty much because we've only got one fifth choice centre back and four first choice centre backs. Sorry, Laporte, but it seems like you've been benched, son. So, yep. And then just around that as well, I remember saying Akanji's not up to it physically. We bought a reserve player and we're starting him every week. That's a load of rubbish, obviously. I think I've been pretty conservative with my bad takes this season. So. Yeah. Oh, actually, I've got a fantastic one. Here's one for you. I did a podcast just before the Real Madrid second leg, and I said I don't want to see Bernardo start because he showed that he didn't offer enough going forward in the first leg. So that was a good one. Two goals later. But again, delighted. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, let's finish with some audience questions. Get them in for next week ahead of the Champions League final on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can also email as well through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. We start with Dan, who says, what do you think of the possibility of signing Mateo Kovacic? It looks pretty nailed on. Could that mean that Gundogan isn't going to extend his deal? Jordan, what do you think to that?
I actually don't think it's much to do with Gundogan. I think we are short in central midfield, and we've been pretty lucky with injuries this season in that while De Bruyne had a few knocks, Gundogan and Bernardo and Rodri have all been pretty available for the whole season. And the lack of trust in Calvin Phillips has put a lot of stress on them. So I think we need at least one, probably two, even before considering outgoings, especially with Gundogan and De Bruyne both being 32. We've got to plan for the future. Yeah, Kovacic is... he's 29, but I think just the depth of having a player like that, we'll probably get them on the cheap as well. I can't see him costing more than 30 million, despite the reports. Chelsea needs to sell players this summer. And he's on his list, speaks for itself. I tweeted it as well. He's won La Liga, Supercopa de España, three Champions Leagues, two UEFA Super Cups, two Club World Cups, then Chelsea, another Champions League. Unfortunately, let's not talk about that one. Europa League, UEFA Super Cup again, another Club World Cup, FA Cup runner-up and EFL Cup runner-up in two separate years, and runner-up at the World Cup in 2018 and third place in 2022. Like, it's how can you turn down someone who's not even 30 years old with that sort of pedigree? So I'm pretty pleased with the signing. I think he's a really good player. He can play across the midfield. I've seen it pointed out that he doesn't really contribute many goals, but Gundogan didn't really contribute many goals when he was at Dortmund, apart from penalties. And that one turned out all right. And also, people question his injury record. We have got a brilliant habit at the moment of turning people who are described as crocs into fitness freaks. I mean, Grealish and Haaland had terrible injury problems, really, before joining City. Grealish's shins were a massive issue. I've not heard of that being a thing since. And yeah, we all heard about Haaland's injury concerns. So faith in the medical department. And I just think it's a really solid signing that shouldn't really impact any moves for the likes of someone like McAllister, for example. So no-brainer for me.
There's another element to this as well, isn't there, Joe, that like generally... City get transfers right, so if they're in for somebody, then they see a gap that they can fill.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that in midfield in particular, we tend to have a really good track record. That obviously, you know, the Calvin Phillips situation this season has been what it is. There's been a lot of he's had a pretty unfortunate injury. He came back from the World Cup not in the best shape, and obviously, when you get into the crunch point of the season, you need players you can absolutely 100% trust. And I think because of that lack of game time, he maybe didn't get it, but next season, we could be looking at Calvin Phillips going, oh, it's another one who, you know, we got right. And it could be just like that. And yeah, I think with Kovacic, there's always the fact as well that even if you're not fully convinced by how he's been at Chelsea, which, you know, a lot of fans haven't been really that convinced by, and maybe there's some understandability in that. I mean, I personally think he's a really good player, and I'm quite happy to get him if it means that we're getting him with 1 year left on his deal at Chelsea and therefore not paying a ridiculous amount of money. I just think that ultimately Pep improves players. Like, even if he came into, what was it, how old was Fernandinho when he joined? Was he 29 as well when Pep came in? And look at the player that Fernandinho was when he left at the end of his deal. Like, the fact that he's 29 isn't going to stop Guardiola from making him a much better player than he was before he got hold of him. So, I've just got no issues with it whatsoever. I don't think it's really, as like Jordan said, I don't think it's really necessarily related to Gundogan. I think it's a nice player to have ready and waiting if Gundogan does decide that this is the end of his City career. But as he says, we need depth anyway. Like, if one of the three had got a serious long-term injury, we would be relying on two midfielders for the rest of the season, pretty much. Plus, obviously, you know, moving one of Phil or maybe Grealish or even Cole Palmer into the number eight. But that's, you know, at that point, apart from Foden, you're really looking at just sort of moving players out of preferred positions into fill that. So, yeah, we need centre mids. He's a very good centre mid. And, you know, as Jordan's pointed out, that CV speaks for itself, doesn't it? The guy knows what he's doing, particularly in Europe, and you can't say no to players like that.
Yeah. Final question then. Jason on Twitter says, there's been talk of a Poznan before the final on Saturday. I wasn't lucky enough to be at the semi-final in 2011, but have seen the images on TV afterwards. How effective do you think that was in creating a sense of occasion for City on the day? No, I wasn't at the 2011 semi-final either. Joe, I think you said you weren't there either. Jordan, yep, were you there?
I was there, yeah. I was 15, so it was a while ago. But I think that was the season in which the Poznan really got its sort of breakout year, was it? Or maybe the season after. That was the season after. But yeah, it was brilliant. And, you know, there's still the sense of excitement when you get to stand up and turn around and not watch the game, jumping up and down. It was good. Personally, when I'm involved in the Poznan, I'm always worried that I'll miss something. But yeah, it's good. It looks good visually, but I think it's... I don't think the players take too much notice. One thing I do remember from that day after the game, though, is that when we were celebrating, all the players in front of us got in a line and turned around and did the Poznan, which was pretty cool to see. I wouldn't mind seeing Haaland and Grealish and all them lot do it after we beat United.
Yeah, Haaland's got form for joining in on things like that as well, so he's, I'm sure he'd be right up for that. Joe, yeah. I think the City fans, I think that time, they decided to do it ahead of the game while the stadium announcer was reading out the United team as a kind of a way to whip up the City players and City fans. Does that need to happen this time? Was it a fact that City were still underdogs at that point? That was part of that, do you think?
Yeah, there was probably definitely more of that in 2011, because obviously we went into that game very much not the favourites. And it definitely did sort of help create that, you know, at that point you need everything you can get from the crowd. I mean, obviously every team needs to have the crowd on side, and particularly loud anyway, particularly in big games. But I think in a game like 2011, where we were not the team that was expected to win it, that matters a lot. And I think, to be honest, if it happened again on Saturday, I'd be loving it. I think it's great to just sort of, it must have some impact on the United players as well, having, you know, while the point where normally you hear your crowd sort of get a bit into it as the team names read out, all you can hear is the opposition fans doing whatever. I think that must have some kind of, even if it's a small psychological impact, it's got to have one. But I'm personally more of a fan of the Poznan coming out when, you know, when the game's underway and we've taken a lead or something, like it came out at Madrid and a couple of games around that as well. I'm personally more of a fan of that, but you know, if it comes out before kickoff, I'm certainly not going to be complaining.
It was worth remembering as well that we basically scored our only chance that game that came from nothing, and Berbatov missed an absolute sitter from like 3 yards in front of our end after about 20 minutes. So I'm not sure whether it had too much of an effect on them. I think we just we seized the moment. But yeah, it's always nice to see, isn't it? I think you're right, Joe. I think it could have a bit of an effect on the players.
Yeah, well, let's have that again this weekend then, everyone. That's the end of this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one. Jordan Elgott.
Cheers.
And Joe Butterfield.
Cheers, thank you very much.
We've got a clip of this week's Patreon show coming up shortly. It's the final one of the season. Patreon backers won't be charged for June and July, so now's the ideal time to sign up and get a taste of what bonus episodes we do. We're going to spend the next couple of months recording some more for next season, so stay tuned for that. Don't forget to get your tickets for the live podcast on June the 14th at Idle Hands in Manchester. Details for that, again, are on our Twitter feed, at Blue Moon Podcast. I'll be back next week to preview the Champions League final and to review whatever happens this weekend. See you on the other side.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
I don't remember any of the emotions other than when Mark Kennedy scored. And even to this day, I challenge anybody to find a goal that has commentary better than Rob Hawthorne's. Dick off here looking to secure the win, and Kennedy probably has done. And the soundtrack to that goal, with everything that it means, honestly, it makes me cry. It's still, like, still to this day, I am 35 years old, it makes me cry because of just what that goal meant to me. The realisation that City needed a point and they'd gone 3-1 up, they were going to win the game. That was it. They were safe. They were done. And there was still about 20 minutes left. Like, that explosion of just pure, raw joy is something that, even experiencing it when Aguero scored, when Gundogan scored for the second time against Villa, when Toure scored against Stoke, those moments, I'm not even sure that they come close to to what I felt for when Kennedy scored against Blackburn that day.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.